It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Biden is preparing U.S. troops for a possible deployment to Eastern Europe with fears of Russia's possible invasion of Ukraine. We'll take a look at that option and others on the table, as well as America's stake in the conflict. First, last fall, leaders and representatives from social media platforms, including Facebook, TikTok, Snapchat, and YouTube, all spent time on Capitol Hill taking questions from lawmakers around the negative impacts of their products on younger users. Congress also heard from a former Facebook data scientist, Francis Haugen, who blew the whistle about internal research showing the company knew its engagement-focused algorithms were harming children, among other socially destructive outcomes, especially on platforms like Instagram. Our next guest was raising these concerns 6 years ago in her book, American Girls. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen your or your children's social media use growing over the last few years? What effects have you seen in them or on yourself? If you were a teen girl over the last few years, if you are one now, what is Instagram in particular like for you? Does it cause stress, anxiety in your life? Do you feel like you grew out of it at some point? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Nancy Jo Sales is a contributing editor to Vanity Fair and regular contributor to The Guardian. She's a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Nothing Personal, My Secret Life in the Dating App Inferno, and American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. Nancy Jo, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, I want to go back to 2016. That's when your book came out. You were on this show actually talking about it. A lot of your book was based on conversations with teen girls about their social media use. What kind of things were you hearing from them back then?
Well, unfortunately, everything that they were telling me then is still a problem today. It was everything from addiction. They were reporting being unable to stop using the platforms, to the bullying and cyberbullying that they were experiencing, and the spilling over of cyberbullying into actual bullying in school. The platforms, as we now have confirmed, are designed to reward aggression, which is terrible for children. They were also telling me about the toxic environment of comparison, you know, comparing oneself to pictures of others. The exposure to things that they really were not able to handle at such a young age, including, you know, violence and pornographic imagery. I mean, it just really went on and on. The sort of things like, you know, just right at the time when you're sort of trying to develop yourself and find out who you are, this kind of creation of a fake self and an authentic self online. I mean, it just went on and on. And some of it was really disturbing, including, you know, I was really the first person to write about, I apologize to some of your listeners if this is uncomfortable, but there were and are these things called slut pages where nude, non-consensually nude images of girls would be shared on these pages, on Facebook, on Instagram. Parents typically knew nothing about it, knew nothing about the normalization of sexual harassment. It was just, you know, sexual harassment is just a sort of mode of talking. And it was a very, very controversial book at the time. It did get a lot of exposure, but it also got a lot of pushback from the tech companies, of course, from various people in the media, including some rather big media outlets who said that, you know, accused me of being a Luddite. You just don't get it. You know, you're raising a moral panic. Meanwhile, I was really just reporting what girls were telling me.
I want to bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Megan is with us in La Crosse. Megan, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about, Megan?
So I wanted to touch on deleting the Instagram application, actually. I deleted Instagram about 2 years ago, and I'm 21 years old. So for me to do that was kind of a lot because a lot of my friends, you know, use Instagram to connect. But I found that I was comparing myself a lot to people on Instagram, whether it was my peers or influencers. So my mental health was kind of declining in that way. So I just decided to delete it altogether, and I feel a lot better not having it in my life.
Megan, I want to ask, I think probably a lot of people in your position have considered getting off of Instagram, but worried that they're going to lose something. They would lose the positive contact with their circle of friends. They wouldn't keep up with what was going on. What was your experience when you deleted Instagram?
I really found it was kind of hard because a lot of my friends like to send me messages on there, like share posts with me on there. But after a while, I just kind of got used to it, to be honest, and I didn't really miss it at all.
Megan, thank you and your kitten for calling in. Thank you so much for sharing your experience. You found, when you wrote the book, Nancy Joe, and I think people have found since, that reluctance, that I feel like it's bad for me, but getting out of it would be bad for me, too. That's part of the addictive and compulsive nature you found.
Yeah, I think that, the platforms are designed to be addictive. They appeal to our neurological systems with these dopamine spikes you get through the likes. This was very much on purpose, that the way that they were constructed. And it is a very toxic thing to give people a product that you know is going to addict them, especially children. And I applaud anyone who has the ability to get off of these platforms and to say no. And I think that is something that a lot of people say, it's impossible, we can't do it, you know. But I would just, you know, I would love you to read my book, but I would also love you to read a little book, and it's a very slim volume called 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Accounts Right Now. And it's important to note who this book is by. It's by someone named Jaren Lanier, L-A-N-I-E-R, who is an internet genius. And he's one of the, pioneers of AI. And he himself has seen and has become very alarmed about the destructive nature of these platforms on our society.
Megan, thanks again for calling in at 800-642-1234. Talking about the impact of Instagram and other social media, especially on teen girls. Nancy Jo Sales is with us, author of the book American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your own experiences. Nancy Jo, you were saying a lot of pushback at the time when you wrote this book in 2016, especially, not exclusively, but especially from technology companies. Then last fall, we had this whistleblower information, a lot of data released to the Wall Street Journal, showing that at least researchers within Facebook, owner of Instagram, knew this stuff was happening. What did you think as you started to see their own internal research coming out?
Well, it really looked to me like they were, I can't say this for a fact, but I do know that my book was one of the first to criticize this effect of these platforms on especially teenagers and children. And it all, with the timing of their internal research at Facebook, it almost looked like they read my book or they became aware of the critique that was suddenly going on in the media. I mean, there was a lot written about it. And they said to them, I mean, I can't prove this, but it really looks like they said to themselves, timing wise, well, maybe let's find out if that's true. Are we doing this? You know, it's something that they probably should have asked before they ever launched these things. And in fact, so much of what my book was about was proven by their own internal research. I mean, what they discovered is really only a sliver of what my book is about. It's really just my book, I think, provides still to this day a much more comprehensive look at all of this. But they did see that they were contributing to negative body image among girls, even, I mean, my God, suicidal ideation. And yet they did not release this information. I think that probably, you know, I can't say for sure, but I guess their plan was to do some internal research and prove that I was wrong and that all of this critique was wrong. But they never released any of this data. They never released any of this information. They totally covered it up, which is why a whistleblower had to come along years later. This was 2017 when they did this. My book came out 2016 and reveal it because they owed this knowledge to the public, because up until that point, there had actually been very little research done in the academic world and among, you know, social scientists. There's a lot now. There's a lot. Ever since my book came out, there's just like a deluge of research and information talking about rising depression, problems with loneliness, and again, the suicidal thoughts among children and teenagers who use these products, and adults too, but it affects kids more. But they swept it under the rug, you know, and the comparison has been made before, similarly to what the tobacco companies did when they knew that tobacco could kill you, cigarettes could kill you, and yet they just let people die.
We're talking to journalist and author Nancy Jo Sales. Her books include American Girls, Social Media, and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. We're talking about the impact of social media apps, the effects they have on young women and girls in particular, how they've changed in recent years. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you have a bad experience with Instagram or other social media platform? Are there regulations or restrictions you'd like to see, especially applying to young people? For Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, and more. Do you see the government having a role to play here? Do you want more transparency from the owners of these social media platforms? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about the impacts of apps like Instagram and Facebook on teenage girls. Nancy Jo Sales is with us, author of the book, American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. Came out in 2016, raising a lot of concerns. Concerns backed up with the leak of internal Facebook research last year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We learned from the whistleblower, Frances Haugen, about Facebook's internal research. I want to listen to an interview on 60 Minutes. She was asked about a couple of these internal studies. More than 13% of teen girls said Instagram made thoughts of suicide worse. 17% of teen girls said Instagram made eating disorders worse. Here's her response.
And what's super tragic is Facebook's own research says, as these young women begin to consume this eating disorder content, they get more and more depressed, and it actually makes them use the app more. And so they end up in this feedback cycle where they hate their bodies more and more. Facebook's own research says it is not just that Instagram is dangerous for teenagers, that it harms teenagers, it's that it is distinctly worse than other forms of social media.
Well, with that cycle, that spiral of harm here, Nancy Jo, do you see any sense of urgency from Congress, from platforms themselves to do something about it?
No, there was a resounding silence when my book came out, and there doesn't seem to be any movement now. I mean, there are people, you know, they periodically haul Mark Zuckerberg before Congress to have an answer to these types of things. And by the way, it's not the only platform on which this is happening, Facebook and Instagram. These aren't the only ones. I teach at a college, and my students, some of my students, young women, were looking into TikTok and what's happening on there, and body image problems and pro eating disorder content are now on TikTok. So it's sort of proliferating everywhere. And are they really taking steps to do anything about it? Not that I have seen. In fact, Instagram came out, you know, right after the Frances Haugen revelations, Instagram came out with a just really pathetic solution, which was that they were going to periodically show users a message that said, hey, do you think you've been on here too long? Maybe take a break. I mean, that is the most cynical thing I can think of. You know, giving people essentially a drug, it's an addictive drug, and saying, hey, have you taken too much heroin? Maybe you want to put down the needle for a little while. I mean, like, that's like the dealer saying that to the user. It's just beyond hypocritical.
Let's go back to our callers now. Bob is with us in Milwaukee. Bob, hi.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking the call. This is a great topic. It's about 15 years too late, but I'm with you. I appreciate that your guest has written the book. I don't see it as particularly a huge revelation, but it, to people that are in the know, but to a lot of people, I think it is. The problem is, just when we need more wisdom and mediation, we got social media, which is neither social nor is it mediated. And it's a real problem because there's no wisdom imparted. There's no expertise to impart any sense of mediation in between users who may or may not know what the heck they're talking about. I've been telling my students for 15 years now, pretty much since the inception of the first social media platforms, to abstain from that because it will not end well. And, you know, maybe not exactly for the same reasons that your author is talking about, but the problem is it's not going to end by appealing to self-regulation. The people who run these companies are making billions of dollars by offering these things. And, you know, you can take it one step further and go to, like, say, hey, I get free email from Google. No, you don't. There's no such thing as a free lunch.
I gotcha. Bob, thanks for the call. Nancy Joe, he says, hey, abstain completely from social media. You mentioned a small book earlier recommending basically the same thing.
Well, I couldn't agree with your caller more in terms of what's really driving all this, which is money. The bottom line is the bottom line, and these tech companies tend to contribute to the campaigns of politicians on both sides of the aisle. I mean, when Trump was in office, Mark Zuckerberg was a friend of Trump. Now he's a friend of Biden. I mean, these guys will, and it mainly is guys who head these companies, they will do whatever they need to do to, you know, ensure their company's profits. And that's really what Frances Haugen confirmed for us, which is that, and I've heard this from, you know, people who reach out to me who work in tech companies too, sort of off the record. They say, look, we want things to change. We are in the ethics department. But every time we raise issues, they always come back to us with engagement. Engagement meaning how much users are on the platforms. The bottom line there is engagement. They just want eyeballs on their screens all the time. And it doesn't matter to them what the fallout is because the business model is use. They just want people using more, more, more. And that's cynical enough when you think about what it does to adults. But when you're talking about young minds, children, you know, and your caller is right also on this score, which is that the misinformation and the disinformation that one finds on Facebook, it's hard enough for adults to distinguish sometimes what's real and what's not. There's no sort of checking or vetting or filters, but it's almost impossible for kids.
Bob, thanks for that call. We're talking to Nancy Joe Sales about social media platforms, the impact they have on everyone, especially young women and girls. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Nancy Joe's the author of the book, American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. Back to your calls now. Peggy is with us in Janesville. Peggy, hi.
Hi. Thank you, Nancy, for that book. I really appreciate that. I wanted to make a comment about TikTok. I was only on for a day or two and quickly realized how dangerous it was. It initially was very funny, and it degraded. The longer I was on it, the almost to pornographic levels. And I thought, well, TikTok is for young people, and how dangerous is that? And I was quite upset and, you know, deleted it. And it got real so bad. It just got so bad.
Peggy, thanks for that call. Nancy Joe, Peggy says she quickly found it was almost a pornographic site. Is that something you've encountered? You were talking about looking at TikTok with your students.
Well, this is, yeah, I mean, TikTok, even on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, there's pornography. And, you know, it was always so surprising to me that people would say that I was raised in a moral panic and that I was, you know, this kind of Miss Grundy, you know, strict school marm type who just didn't want the kids to have their fun. That is ridiculous. There's nothing that says that children should see pornography. I mean, anybody who thinks that, I just don't understand that. And there is no sort of, there's no sort of regulation or filter on any of this content, this pornographic content coming onto these screens. And parents often have no idea really what their children, and sometimes it's really young children, are seeing. I mean, I've interviewed 13-year-olds and younger even who have seen things that they really just shouldn't see. And it's on YouTube. And it's not because we're not quote unquote sex positive. It's because we don't, you know, as a society, we actually have laws that say that children should not consume pornography, and yet they do, and they can on social media. So I agree with her.
Thanks for the call, Peggy. And just our last minute and a half, what solutions do you see? What kind of changes would you hope for at the top of your mind with these issues that go back to your book and beyond?
There has to be government regulation. I mean, there's government regulation of almost every industry to some extent. You know, that, like, industries shouldn't just be able to act willy-nilly and harm people. Once upon a time, there was no regulation of the meat industry, you know, and people were getting sick and dying. It's a problem really comes down to one particular law that's, this is a little wonky, but it's Section 230 of that aspect of internet law that was passed in the late 90s that says that what happens on these platforms, the tech companies cannot be held responsible for what third parties do. And that's really a problem, because that means that third parties, meaning users, anyone out there, can do anything, and these tech companies can never be sued. Well, if you're a company and you have a product, but you can never be sued for anything that happens with your product, then why are you ever, when the bottom line is the bottom line, why are you ever going to take responsibility?
Nancy Jo, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Nancy Jo Sales, contributing editor for Vanity Fair, author of the 2016 book American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. We talked with her about what has and hasn't changed over the years and the ways that social media apps operate and influence teenage girls. Now, ahead of a potential invasion of Ukraine, Russia is conducting large-scale military drills, some of them near the Russia-Ukraine border. According to Russian officials, the exercises involved tanks, drones, infantry troops, and elite paratroopers. Three Navy ships also took part in joint drills with the Chinese fleet in the Arabian Sea. The moves come a day after the U.S. placed 8,500 troops on high alert. The Defense Department said they, along with warships and aircraft, could be deployed to NATO allies in the Baltics and Eastern Europe. Here's Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby yesterday.
The United States will act firmly in defense of its national interests in response to actions by Russia that harm us, our allies, our partners. As part of that commitment, the Department of Defense maintains significant combat-capable forces forward in Europe to deter aggression and enhance the alliance's ability to defend allies and defeat aggression if necessary.
The State Department also ordered all non-essential staff and family members from the U.S. Embassy in Kiev to leave Ukraine over the weekend. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do you want to see the U.S. do about Ukraine? How should America be involved, or is it not our business? We should stay out. And what questions do you have about the conflict between Russia and Ukraine and U.S. policy in the region? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Lowell Barrington is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. He is also a research affiliate with UW-Madison's Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia. Lowell, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. It's good to be back. I wish one of these times it would be on a cheerier topic, though.
Unfortunately, yeah, we tend to call you when things are bad in the area of Russia. Well, what do we know about why Russia is threatening Ukraine in the first place?
Well, it's a good question. I think one of the things to remind people is that Russia already controls Crimea from its invasion in 2014, and that there are pro-Russian forces in control of parts of eastern Ukraine as well. So in a way, this is a really new and dangerous escalation of the situation there, but it's not new that that Putin has been interested in establishing a Russian sort of foothold over Ukraine. I think that there's a few things that are going on here. Some of them are some things related to timing. I think one of the things that people haven't talked a lot about is the, what we might call the Germany factor here, which is there is a new ruling coalition in Germany led by Olaf Scholz, who replaced, as you know, Angela Merkel, who had been the longest serving leader in Europe and a real anchor to kind of a European unity in a lot of ways on different issues. And there's also a German link to this Nord Stream pipeline, which has now been laid and was supposed to be up and running by now, bringing natural gas, or sorry, oil, I think, from Russia to Germany. And those things are part of Putin looking for sort of cracks in European unity that he can exploit in this particular time? So I think the kind of timing question, at least, has got some things to do with that.
What do you make of Putin's, I guess, psychology in all this when it comes to Ukraine, his desire to have influence there and his willingness to go to brinksmanship and maybe past?
That's a great question, because I think he's often portrayed as this completely non-ideological sort of strategic genius, right? And I'm certainly not going to say he's dumb or crazy, but you know, he's made mistakes. He's gotten lucky at times with some things that he's done and has gotten kind of bailed out of it at home, partly because of his control of the political system. But he does absolutely have what I guess I might call an ideational anchor, which is this belief that in the 1990s, the West and then Russian President Boris Yeltsin basically deeply undermined Russia's domestic international strength. And his mission really since 2000 has been to steal the line of making a country great again, to kind of reestablish Russian greatness. And I think along the way to both weaken the U.S. to an extent as a model of democracy, but also try to weaken this unity within the West and Europe as well.
Why is the U.S. interested in Ukraine and protecting it? It's not a NATO ally. What would the American interest be here?
I mean, it borders a number of NATO countries that had been part of the Warsaw Pact countries in the past or part of the Soviet Union in the case of the Baltic states. And so it's in that general area where NATO is already established. And I think there's also a sense that we know that Putin will push at times until he's unable to kind of get away with things. And what happened in 2014 went against a stated agreement in 1994. I think it was called the Budapest Memorandum, and it was about the U.S. and U.K. and Russia basically agreeing to Ukraine's sovereignty in exchange for Ukraine giving up nuclear weapons. I mean, it was a really major concession on Ukraine's part from a security standpoint, and one of the reasons they did it was this understanding that their borders would be protected. So I think part of the problem is what he did in 2014, he largely got away with. I mean, there were sanctions that were somewhat effective at times, especially as oil prices dropped, they were effective. But we've rolled some of those back recently, and I think he feels like he largely got away with what he did before. So I think that one of the things we have to do for the good of European stability is just to show that, in fact, Europe is united in protecting borders and protecting against a kind of further Russian expansion.
Dr. Lowell Barrington from Marquette University, looking at the latest on Russia and Ukraine. You can join in with your thoughts about an American role there, if any. You can join in at 800-642-1234, or if you have questions, 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I appreciate this opportunity to discuss this scholarly topic. I look at it at an intellectual point of view, and I think of myself, if I was a Russian citizen or if I was a Ukrainian citizen, and you look back hundreds of years, 500 years ago, 800 years ago, Ukraine has always been a part of Russia. It's known as the breadbasket of Russia. And the independence movement since the revolution of 1917 has asserted, has given Ukrainians the assertion that they can be independent of Russia. But when you look at the history of it, I can see Russian. I don't consider this aggression. This is part of unifying Russia. But I know my opinion is a minority, but my question is, years ago there was a vote, and the people in Ukraine voted, just like Crimea voted, whether they wanted to rejoin Russia or stay independent. And the Russians won. The people of Ukraine voted to rejoin Russia. But then the left said, oh, it was a fraudulent election, and then they reasserted themselves over any kind of transition.
Jeff, thanks for the call. A lot there. First of all, was there a vote? I know there was a vote, I think, managed by the Russians in Crimea itself. Was there something like that in Ukraine, Lowell?
Not a legitimate one nationwide, but clearly there were votes in places in Ukraine that were supportive of parts of the country moving back to Russia. I think the question is really interesting in terms of history. I mean, it's really important that we think about that. I would push back a little bit from the Ukrainian side, and I think Ukrainian nationalists, for example, would have a response to the kind of Russian nationalist take of Ukraine being a part of Russia, which is the birthplace of what became the Russian Empire was actually Kiev. It was the area was called Kievan Rus, and it was really the area of current Ukraine that gave birth to everything else that became Russia later on. So I think for them, in some ways, you know, it's really Ukraine has a right to control itself because, in fact, it was the start of all of this, and it can decide if it wants to be part of Russia or not. So I think it's a great question, though, to have in mind the depth of the connection between these two countries, because, again, as they were part of the Soviet Union together, they were connected. At least parts of Ukraine were part of the traditional Russian Empire previous to the Soviet Union. So I appreciate the caller bringing up the history. I think this is something we need to keep in mind.
I saw a Lithuanian member of parliament tweeted something out saying, well, Ukraine was once part of the Polish-Lithuanian Empire, as were parts of Russia, so why can't we make a claim there? That, I mean, this sort of maximalist claim in Eastern Europe has led to a lot of border disputes.
Right, and I think that's one of the things that the West, in particular the U.S. and the U.K., thought that they had resolved with this agreement in 1994 that Russia had signed on to about the borders of Ukraine being set, and that we weren't going to revisit the idea of carving up territory and moving it around anymore.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. We'll go to Valerie now in Madison. Valerie, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I hope this doesn't sound too far off, but it reminds me of Adolf Hitler coming to power in a very impoverished Germany in the 30s, and Neville Chamberlain in England trying to negotiate with him and thinking they had struck a deal, and then Hitler, you know, going, I think, into Czechoslovakia and Poland. And although their personalities seem to be different, it just strikes me as kind of like that. And I don't think Putin is just thinking about Ukraine, but over the long haul, maybe getting the rest of the former Soviet republics under his purview.
Valerie, thanks for the call. What do you think, Lowell?
That's always a tough analogy. I think anything related to the rise of Hitler, we have to be really careful about comparing to different things going on, especially in contemporary situations today. But that said, there are some things that we need to keep in mind about what Putin has as broader goals. Again, he wants himself and Russia to be seen as strong. He wants attention on himself for being a major global player. He wants Russia to be seen as not just a regional power, but a global power. And those were certainly things that we've seen in past from leaders that have been expansive in territorial claims. He certainly wants a more limited role for the U.S. in Europe, and Europe to be much less unified. And one of the other really important things about this is he wants democracies in other countries to struggle. So, you know, that's true in countries like the U.S., and we've talked about how he has, you know, reveled in shaking up American politics via social media attacks and other things he's done. But it's really true in countries like Ukraine, because if Ukraine can develop into a successful democracy, it really undermines that authoritarian blueprint that Putin has offered to other countries in Eastern Europe and around the world. And I think that's one of the things we need to kind of keep in mind about his broader goals is I think the caller is onto something, that this is a piece of something larger for him. But there's also something deep and important about Ukraine itself, as Jeff was talking about earlier in the call, that there is a connection psychologically about Ukraine. And the thought of Ukraine becoming a NATO member or even a European Union member is something that's hard for a lot of Russians to think about, and certainly would be hard for Putin to take.
Thanks for the call. We're talking about Russia and Ukraine and how the White House is approaching the conflict. Lowell Barrington is our guest, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do you want to see the U.S. do about this situation? How involved should America be? A little, a lot, or not at all? What questions do you have about Russia, Ukraine, and American policy? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about what's going on now in Russia and Ukraine. As many as 8,500 U.S. troops are on alert to potentially be deployed to Eastern Europe ahead of a potential Russian invasion of Ukraine or further invasion of Ukraine. State Department also evacuated non-essential staff and family members from the U.S. Embassy in Kiev. Lowell Barrington is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University and Research Affiliate with UW-Madison Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. We'll go back to your calls now. Matt is with us in Milwaukee. Matt, hi.
Hi. I was wondering what role, I guess, the balance between military and economic support that the United States provides for Ukraine. It seems like NATO and United States military are very enthusiastic in providing support. And I wonder if maybe telling Russia that the United States wouldn't extend NATO membership with Ukraine would fix things. I know if like Russia extended membership in the CIS or something to Mexico or Canada, that might make the United States a little nervous.
Matt, thanks for the call. And Lowell, this is a central issue here. Ukraine is not currently in the process to join NATO. Putin wants Ukraine to not be allowed to join NATO ever. NATO wants to at least keep the door open, I guess. How important is that part of the story?
It's a huge part of the story. Ukraine has expressed interest in European Union membership. In fact, there's some thought they may apply for EU membership as soon as 2024. It's going to be very difficult for them to make a case for NATO membership, and I think this is one of the reasons for what we're seeing now and why Putin is doing this is that, you know, I talked about these kind of broad goals he has. He has a narrower goal here, which is keeping Ukraine unstable. And the more unstable it is, and the more unstable its democracy is, then the less likely that kind of case can be made for EU membership, not to mention NATO membership, and the less that Ukraine is a model for a kind of working, functioning Western-style democracy. So I think that clearly NATO membership has, an expansion of NATO has been a major point in Russian political discussions and certainly Putin's take on things going on in Europe today. And that's part of why he's working, again, so hard to try to kind of create divides within the European unity, pitting some of the security people against more of the economic focused and politically focused people in some of these governments, and then also just you know, really working to turn some of the members even against themselves, or at least create kind of different statements, which we saw in the last week where we had, you know, Macron in France making a really unfortunate statement in a way about reestablishing talks involving Germany and France and Russia and Ukraine, which would have shut out the UK and US from those talks, right? So a lot of what he's doing is to kind of try to get these divisions in Ukraine again, divisions in Europe again over Ukraine. But it's also really about making sure Ukraine is not a member of NATO. And I think one of the ways you do that is say, we don't want them in NATO. Another way you do it is to make things so chaotic and unstable in Ukraine that there's no way NATO would want Ukraine as a member.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to John in Eau Claire. John, hi.
Hi. I had two questions. One of them was secondary effects of a military action in Ukraine by Russia. What would this embolden China to take military action in Taiwan and potentially further impact the semiconductor supply chain? And then the second question would be, does it embolden more countries to start abandoning the petrodollar system and potentially igniting inflation in the U.S.
John, thanks for the call. First of all, I know some in Congress are worried about that. If Putin can invade a country that he notionally says is actually already part of Russia, well, China feels the same way about Taiwan.
Yeah, that's a really good analogy, isn't it, between those two situations. I think that is a real concern for us. I think the other way I would put it is one of the things that we see in terms of secondary effects is the focus on Ukraine and a Russia invasion takes the focus off China for a while, which would give it an opening to put more pressure on Taiwan in certain ways, if not actually attack Taiwan. I'm not someone who thinks China is itching to attack Taiwan soon, but I think, again, we need to always think about these spillover effects like the John had mentioned. And I think any time you get one of these activities, what it does is deflect attention away from other things. And for Putin, that also means deflecting attention away from things going on in Russia, where he's been struggling. You know, his approval rating is, by American standards, great. It's about 59% in the last thing that I saw. But, you know, for Putin, that's not great. And we've had seen big protests last year in Russia and things like that. So I think there's also a domestic benefit to Putin in this way of kind of making the attention on Ukraine and not on how things are going in Russia itself.
John, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Richard in Two Rivers. Richard, hello.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I have it's actually a two-part question. And one is, how much is this political, trying to develop a democracy in a country next to communism? And I'm sure we have nuclear warheads there. And I want to know the comparison between the Bay of Pigs when Russia was developing nuclear arms in Cuba. And I would like to know your guest speaker's opinion on it.
Richard, thanks for the call. So first of all, proximity, I think of democracy or at least elected government versus authoritarianism, not communism anymore in Moscow. I mean, is there that fundamental question here, Lowell?
Sure. And I'd mentioned that before. I think that, again, for Putin, being a model of a stable, strong system of government is important. It's important for Russia in getting connections with other countries where there aren't democracies. And Putin has really wanted to discredit Western-style democracy for a long time. So this is part of the story, again, of making Ukraine unstable as it makes its democracy unstable. So I think there is absolutely this desire for Putin on that part. I think at the same time, we also would desperately hope that Eastern Europe, even some of the NATO members, but certainly also a country like Ukraine, would be making strides to strengthen, not step back from democracy. And so I think that yes, both sides have a kind of interest there in terms of the ultimate political situation in a country like Ukraine as a model, for lack of a better way of saying it. I want to say something really quickly. I really was intrigued by the Bay of Pigs analogy. It's not that in that we don't have a nuclear weapons situation in the same way, but today, ironically, and again, thinking about deflecting attention away from things, the Kremlin actually announced a new agreement with Cuba to potentially have a much more significant Russian military presence in Cuba as well. So I think that may be a little bit of Putin kind of taking a shot. If we're going to expand our troop presence in Eastern Europe, we might expect some Russian troop increases in a country like Cuba.
Thanks for that call. In our last minute and a half or so, Lowell, I won't ask you to predict what's going to happen next, but what are you watching for? What signals are you watching for as we try to figure out what's going to happen next?
That's a good question. I think one thing I'd ask people to kind of just keep in mind is one of the things about these tensions escalating is that both sides are kind of locked into that happening for a bit, and that's a little scary. Putin may not invade. I actually don't personally think there's going to be a massive invasion. I think there will be other kinds of smaller incursions and other cyber attacks and things like that. But he's kind of locked himself into doing something here because of the size of the troop buildup. But one thing would also be to kind of listen to the rhetoric and the extent to which Russia starts talking about the U.S. as the threat and NATO as the threat, which we've started to see more in the last few days. And it's part of a strategy. It's the English word is provocation. Russian, it's provokatsiya. But that provokatsiya is this whole idea of you get the other side to be believed by your own people as the reason that you have to do something, that they are provoking Russia to act. And so we're seeing from Russia this idea of NATO is, in fact, and the talks about the U.S. expanding troop presence in Eastern Europe as a provocation that makes it even more important for Russia to have this strong presence along the border or inside Ukraine. So I think the more that we see that idea of kind of the U.S. as a provocation, the worse things look, I think, in terms of how they're going to go. I do think Putin could still kind of back out of this. I think he could find some things to pitch to his own people about it being a win, but it's getting increasingly difficult. And I think there is likely to be, again, if not a full-blown massive land invasion, I think there'll be some increases in tensions before things get better.
Lowell, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Lowell Barrington is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. We talked to him today about the Biden administration's approach to the Russian threats toward Ukraine. Keep following news at WPR.org. We will have reporting from NPR as the situation continues to develop there.